Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the director of the new documentary, The World We Want, Mr. Patrick Davidson, and the composer of the new horror film, Splinter, Mr. Elias Smirol, coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We got a great show for you tonight. How are you doing, Jerry?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm great. We're looking forward to this one tonight. A really great response to our show last week.
An enormous response.
You couldn't ask for
a better response. And it was a lot of fun to do as well, even despite the technical difficulties at first.
Yeah, but we got over those, and there's actually an edited version up as well that's done phenomenal. Darren Lynn Bousman, the director of a new film called Repo, the Genetic Opera, he also directed some of the Saw films. He joined us just in time for Halloween. And we got a lot of people on in the chat room, and we appreciate your support very much for that one. Upcoming shows, let me just fill you in real quick. We have Damian Harris, who is a fascinating director. He comes on with us on Wednesday. If you might remember, in the 90s, he directed some terrific films like Deceived with Goldie Hawn and Bad Company with Larry Fishburne and Ellen Barkin. And then he disappeared for a while. He's made some things here and there, but he has a fantastic-looking new film coming out called Gardens of the Night with John Malkovich. He'll be joining us on Wednesday night to tell us all about it. And an actor that we all love, Robert Davi, will be with us next Sunday night. He's a cool cat. So that's gonna be interesting.
He is.
Our ET tribute will be Wednesday the 12th, and the first part of our series paying tribute to the great decade of filmmaking, the 1970s, will take place Wednesday, November 19th, where we'll start out with, of course, 1970, and give an in-depth analysis of Five Easy Pieces, Little Big Man, and MASH, and we'll have people that were part of those productions on to speak to all of those films. So you ready to get started tonight?
Let's do it.
Okay. Jerry will be manning the chat room tonight. If you have any questions for either of our guests tonight, just submit them through the chat room, and Jerry will cut in here and ask them for you. We also have a call-in number. The number is 718-508-9477. And let's get right to it. Change. Now, you hear that word rallied about nonstop throughout a political season like this one. And we all know that our biggest hope for substantive change comes from our greatest resource, our children. And at a time when our greatest enemy might be apathy, it's refreshing to see a film like The World We Want, a globe-trotting documentary that follows young teens as they put plans in motion to change the world. The film comes courtesy of producer, writer, director Patrick Davidson, who lovingly captures the hopes, dreams, and actions of children throughout the world who work to make their own difference, whether they're fighting for healthier school lunches or creating a town constitution. This is a terrific, uplifting film, and here's a quick clip from it.
Project Citizen was this project that Miss Fowler introduced to us, and we remember hearing at the beginning of the year, and we're like, oh man, because we didn't like the idea of a group project, but our whole class would be on it.
Okay, so we have this list here, and it's pretty diverse, isn't it? You need to pick the one problem you feel strongest about.
Okay, so you came up with the slogan. That's what you're going to start off with? Like, that's your hook?
Yeah.
Do you want to wake up 100 pounds heavier than you are today? So is it possible that our little class could ban trans fat in lunches? Is that possible?
I think if we get government support, we can.
How are you going to convince the school board?
Food is like what we eat every day, and so it's like affecting our everyday lives.
So you're saying that this, your selection of the problem has a a stronger impact on your life, daily life, day-to-day life.
I mean, what we're doing now, which is eating unhealthy food, is affecting us now. And, you know, if we continue to eat all this food, you know, it's going to negatively affect us in the future.
Please welcome producer, writer, director, Mr. Patrick Davidson to Movie Geeks United. Let me bring him up real quick.
Well, thank you.
Mr. Davidson, hello. How are you?
Patrick is fine, and I'm doing great. It's wonderful to hear somebody else talk about my film in such glowing introduction. It's always exciting to talk to somebody, see somebody who really gets it, what we're trying to do with the film, and you captured it, which I really appreciate.
It's fantastic. It's a great film, and especially for this time, and I definitely want to touch on that a little bit later in our conversation. But give me a sense of you. How did you start in the entertainment field?
Well, I've been in the entertainment field for about 30 years. I entered as a runner, you know, $50 a week, you know, go for this, go for that, your traditional gopher. And I was actually working for a company that was doing a lot of promotion for ABC. So, in fact, the first documentary project I did, it was with Alex Haley in Henning, Tennessee, on Roots. But since then, I've done quite a few things. And, you know, in both production and promotion, and then for then it kind of evolved, and I was the head of programming for the Disney Channel for 6 years, and which is a fabulous experience at the time when we were really trying to turn that around. So, and I had a kind of a carte blanche. I did everything from music shows to developed the Mickey Mouse Club and all kinds of different things, American Teacher Awards. So I came into this business knowing very little, but just a passion for storytelling. And one of the great things about this business, that in many ways it's an apprenticeship program. So if you really have a passion and you hustle and you connect with the right people, and you get lucky, you can do something, well, quite frankly, like the world we want.
Well, and you reading about you, you have had your fingers in a lot of pies and had some experience all over the map in putting these projects together. And there's also a common thread here where a lot of the work that you've done, starting with Alex Haley, as you discussed, have a social consciousness base. And I'm wondering, before you got into the film and TV entertainment industry, were those the kind of films that inspired you that had something relevant like that to say?
Absolutely. I think so. I think any time, not just films, television shows, books. And the fact is, before I was in this business, if you go way back, I actually used to be a probation officer working with delinquent kids. So, and people made a documentary about that, and I was really intrigued and never thought that I could actually work in this business. But, like I say, got lucky. But, yeah, I've always been touched by, like we all are, I call it the goosebump test. You know, when something hits you and you go, yeah, it really resonates and you feel like you're part of that, or somebody's telling your story or just connects with you. That's the magic of what we can do in entertainment.
And your film is about kids that work to make the world a better place. And I'm curious, do you think that films and filmmakers can do that too?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that we're given a very special time, a very special opportunity, and when we can, you know, having seen kids see this film, for example, I showed it to it. We had a special screening last Friday for 300 middle school kids, and to have them react the way they did, they were cheering, they loved the story, they got it, and you see in their eyes that they say, I want to be like that. I want to do something like that. And so, you know, your introduction, you talked about it. We're at a time where so many things are negative and so many things are put down. And kids, so many kids are put down. To have them see that others can do something really positive and they can say, I want to do that too. Yeah, we can connect. And movies, there's nothing in the world, absolutely for me personally, there's nothing in the world like being in that big black box and having it take you someplace where you've never been, and for that couple of hours, you get to share something so intimate and so special. Yeah, it's just wonderful.
And it's one of the few remaining communal experiences we have as well, and it's powerful medium. Tell me about this project, The World We Want. how this idea came to you.
The idea, there are two sides to that. One is that about 3 years ago, my wife said, you know, you've produced stuff for all kinds of people, which is, you know, all the networks and various folks. And she said, why don't you find something you really want to do and let's get behind it on our own. So this is a totally independent project. And so I was looking around, and I knew the people who run this on an international basis. It's a government education project, which sounds really boring. And the name of the project is called Project Citizen, which is not a great name for a film. But I got close to it, and I actually did a small story in Kentucky, a wonderful story of some kids in Hazard, Kentucky, as in the Dukes of Hazard. And they took on an issue in their little town, and they made a change. And I wanted to know more, and the people who run the program started telling me stories about things across the U.S., and in particular, things internationally, what kids are doing. And we're talking kids that are like 12 years old, 13 years old, that go on the big fight. They take on an issue that is really important to them, and they battle. And to me, I was just absolutely hooked. I was totally hooked. I love kids. I love the power of kids. I love the passion of kids. And to be able to use the tools that we have as a movie to let them tell their story, because in this case they do. There's no narrator. The kids tell the story from start to finish. And so I was hooked. And so what I did was I went to a meeting where directors from all over the world who run this program, they were meeting in Warsaw. And as a movie person, you would appreciate that I went to this meeting and I invited about 25 of the countries, because it's in 65 countries. And I had them pitch to me why I should come to their country and tell their story. And so it actually set up a little bit of a competition, and the stories were wonderful. And so then I narrowed it down to about 8, went on a survey, and went to each country. But then within each country, they would take me to different places to show me different stories. And every place, the kids just knocked me out. They were just wonderful, really, really empowered and really passionate about what they were doing. And so it was difficult to select. But it was from a filmmaking standpoint, it was an abundance of riches. You know, I could pick from a variety of things.
And it's an incredibly ambitious project, too. Just in terms of, I mentioned it was globetrotting. Let's talk about some of the countries that are involved here. There's Colombia, India, Russia, Jordan. What other countries are we spotlighting?
Indonesia, Senegal, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and we shot it back-to-back. We were basically in each country for a week, so we went to Indonesia and shot, and then went to India and shot. And so in an 8-week period, scaled to about 10, but we literally went all over the world. I took a cameraman, Kurt Miles, who was just phenomenal. Alan Tabner is the best sound man in the business. I call him MacGyver, because wherever I get stuck, Alan comes up with a way to get me out. And the fourth person was actually my wife, who's not only has a production background, so she's also a nurse. So I was able to, we had that base covered. And then in each country, we were basically taking really well-meaning people and turning them into a film crew overnight. They'd never done this, but they were so eager to help, and the stories were there. And I picked a crew, Alan and Kurt, who I knew would get along with people and would enjoy working with people who didn't necessarily know how everything worked but had their hearts in the right place. So it was, a very ambitious project. You're always expecting something to go wrong, that, you know, when you know the camera's going to dump in the dirt, or that you're going to get something locked up, or you're going to get stuck in customs, because, of course, we had to go in and out of 8 countries. We were taking 12 cases of equipment. And, you know, there's all kinds of stories coming out of India. They told us, well, you can't put that stuff on the plane. We can't, you know, you have to ship it. And I said, no, you don't understand. We have to shoot tomorrow in Jordan. They said, oh, it's impossible. So you have to work through all of these, every country, every village, to get it done. And we got lucky. We got it all.
At the same time, I would think that it would be so much more cumbersome if it wasn't for, I know this is shot in HD, if it wasn't for that technology. Did you find that technology was very conducive to this process?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a beautiful film. It really is gorgeous. There are shots in Colombia in particular. I mean, just all over the place. Indonesia, we're in rice fields. In Colombia, we're in the mountains. And I can go on and on. But absolutely, the technology to have that kind of richness that you can put in a box and pull out and shoot, and you're to be able to get that kind of quality. Plus, it's just so much faster and so much easier to move.
Mm-hmm.
We were
mm-hmm.
It's a documentary. You know, we were there are scenes in Jordan, for example, where we go to a school and the kids are talking. And by the way, I only speak English, and so these kids were speaking Arabic. I didn't know what they were saying. I had a translator, but I kind of had a sense. But to be able to move quickly and react when the moment appears, there's just no way. And so being able to shoot it on HD, so you get the richness of film, but the flexibility of shooting in smaller format, it's just great.
Yeah, that portability is incredibly valuable, and it's especially affected the documentary field. A documentary filmmaker after another, one after another that we have on the show, they all speak to the value of the HD format. Let's talk about the content. The United States, I know those kids that you follow here in the U.S., they fought for healthier lunches and other topics, teenage gambling and lower taxation. I'm wondering, with all of these kids and their concerns and hopes and dreams for the future, how they differ from country to country, but most importantly, how they're the same.
Well, you hit both of them. You know,
yeah.
They're different because you're right, because they come from, you know, different circumstances and everything from and different environments. We in Delhi, we were shooting in a city of 12 million, and we were in a school that's a pretty privileged school. And, you know, they're all wearing uniforms. It's a special, you have to get, you know, apply to be accepted. It's a semi-private school. And then in Senegal, we were in, you know, a cinder block building where literally when we got there to outline the schedule, they had to send somebody to the principal's office to get a piece of chalk so we could write on the blackboard. And it really was an old blackboard. So, yeah, the circumstances are very different. But the kids are the same because their heart is in the right place. They're really trying to change things. And they really – and it's not negative. That's the thing, I think, that hit all of us. We get caught up in, oh, we're going to change something out of guilt or out of, gee, this is a terrible thing and we have to change this. And we try to make people feel badly about it. The kids are so positive about the future. They know they're going to create a better world. And they know they have the power to do it. And a couple of times in the film, I remember distinctly a kid in Russia says it, and one in Senegal and one in Colombia, talks about the fact that we can't rely on the adults. They're not going to do it. We have to do this. We have to step up and make the change. So that was the common factor throughout, that regardless of what the issue was, in Colombia, we're in an absolutely idyllic community called Alejandría, which was just gorgeous. And in fact, we were told we were the first people from North America ever to go there.
Wow.
And it had been devastated with the wars with the drug cartels. And these kids took on an issue. They had all kinds of problems. And they decided we're going to put it all into one and write our own town constitution, basically a rule book of how we should all live, what a civil society is. They're 12 years old, 13 years old. And they went
That's
to
amazing.
The city council and they passed it. And the kids in India, they wanted to restore a monument that's behind their school that had been run down, and it was a haven for drug dealing, and it was next to this really slum. And what they wanted to do, and this is so ambitious, these kids wanted the people who live in the surrounding area, they wanted them to take pride in the monument and them to fix it up and them to protect it. And they've done it. And so they were doing street theater and doing plays with the kids and doing afternoon classes of art lessons and all kinds of things, because they knew that to make the change, they needed the whole community. It wasn't just something to go to the government officials. They also did that. And, of course, the great thing about kids this age, when you're talking 12, 13, 14-year-olds, they can get in to meet anybody. Think about
yeah.
it. If you call your local congressman and said, I got 8 12-year-olds who want to come by and meet you, it's like a photo op. Well, yeah, we're there. Great. Come on,
man.
Now, if you say I've got 8 18-year-olds or 20-year-olds, they're going to say, what do they want to know? What's their issue?
Right.
So you walk in with young kids. You know, young teenagers, they can get in any door, and they're very charming. And then, as you see time and again in this film, they just bust them. And they say, you know, you say you don't have any money, but here in this newspaper article, this happened in India, this girl is a very beautiful, gentle, idyllic girl, says, but it says in the newspaper article that you've got millions of dollars that you can spend on this. How come you're telling us you don't? And the officials, like the deer in the headlights, what does it say?
Right.
And it happened in Bosnia, and it happened in Colombia. So, and again, and these kids, you know, have the guts to do it. As an adult, we tend to go, gee, you know, I heard about something. There was an article I read about that said, oh, by the way, kids just bust right through it. And they say, what about this? And they're fearless. And that's why they're so powerful.
I agree. And you see that in spades in this film. In terms of this program, obviously they do work throughout the world, but how widespread are they here in the States? I mean, how many districts do they work in?
Yeah, it's truly a village by village, state by state program. It's in all 50 states. And the way I typically describe it is that it's available to every state. It's quite frankly, you and I pay for it because it's funded by Congress as far as the training and the materials. It's very, very simple. Because it isn't like you have to have any sophisticated equipment to do this. You have to have a good idea and passion to go do the research and, you know, I mean, and, you know, do your homework and talk to people. And then you present it when the kids compete for their issue against another city or another, you know, school. Quite frankly, it kind of looks like a science fair. They have the boards up and they say, here's our issue. And it's all done. It's a level playing field. Here's the issue. Here's how we're going to attack it. Here's the action plan. Here's what we want to do. It's in all 50 states, and they have to deal with the different school systems to have it fit within the standards that have been established and put on top of teachers these days. I mean, it's, as we know, being a teacher, I think, is they walk on water, and that's why I created the American Teacher Awards years ago to recognize them. But they have so many things, so many hoops they have to jump through because of No Child Left Behind and funding
right.
and other things. So the clever ones figure out a way to take this program and say, you know, they can take it anywhere from it's a math program because you got to do a lot of research. It's writing, so it's English. And they, you know, the clever ones bend it around. But it isn't in various states, and if people go to the website for theworldwewantmovie.com, they can link to the Project Citizen program and learn about that. It's a great organization. They've been doing this for like 20 years. It's just fabulous.
It's a beautiful idea.
It's a great idea. I'll tell you, since you mentioned the U.S., I'll tell you, and there are news stories every single day because it keeps going. I mean, I kind of took a snapshot in time, right, and covered these 8 stories. But I keep reading and learning and talking to kids and learning more. I ran across a program in New Mexico, the Navajo Indians on the reservation. These kids are wonderful, and what they're fighting against is uranium mining on the reservation. They're really battling a big company because they're polluting and it's a terrible thing, and they've been, you know, rather abusive. So the kids, that was their presentation, and they're fighting that, and they got recognition, and they were invited to a conference in New Orleans to talk about that. But the deal was they got – the people in New Orleans would pay for their hotel and everything, but they had to get there. They had to pay their own way, which is tough. I mean, you could fly a team to New Orleans. So the kids still did what all these kids do. They went to the uranium company and asked them to pay for it, and they got them to pay for the trip to New Orleans.
Wow.
That's what the kids do.
Tell me about the reaction that you've had so far. If I'm not mistaken, you premiere the AFI Fest. Is it November 8th?
Right, next Saturday.
At the Grauman's Chinese Theater. That's a pretty good venue.
It's as good as any venue. Six, which is next to it. But yeah, we're very flattered, and AFI has been just phenomenal. They gave us a premiere slot Saturday night at 7:00. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better slot. And they've actually done something unique with it. They've made it a free screening. So because they really think it's kind of like what you described when you started. This is the film a lot of people who might not, you know, traditionally go to film festivals. But they might say, this is something I'd like to go to. This is something I might want to take my kids to. And that's what we're finding. Quite frankly, it's sold out in 4 days. And then as far as screens go, I did testing, you know, like any filmmaker. I, you know, not just friends and family, but I try to reach beyond that. I know a number of teachers, and midway I sent a cut out, a rough cut out, and this is my, so far, I mean, I've been very flattered. We've had some wonderful reviews. Your comments and others have been very positive, but early on I got the following. I sent it out, and a teacher showed it in a high school, and she called me that night and said, you know, they really love the film. And I said, well, you're just saying, no, they really love it. And she says, it's real simple. I can tell you how much they love the film. Nobody fell asleep, and no one was text messaging during the film.
You got them.
Thank you.
That's how you know you got them.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So your hopes for this in the future, obviously you said that there's a great many stories to be told here. Did I read it correctly where you hope to make this a television series?
That would be a second dream come true, if you will, because the first one is making this. So, yeah, as you said, we're premiering next Saturday. We're just now showing it to people. That's why you've just seen it. And I believe that because there are so many stories, it's in 65 countries, it's in all 50 states, and that's without people knowing about it. I mean, think about it. When people start, everybody who's seen it, and I'm sure you hear this from every filmmaker, everybody loves my film. Well, I can tell you that's the case. And
yeah.
I get people saying, you know, can I buy it? Can I, you know, where can I see it? I want to show it to my school and so on. There are amazing stories going on, and that's without kids seeing this themselves. My point being that this thing can scale in a big, big way. So, yes, in an ideal world, and I think there's a distinct possibility, this could be an ongoing television series. This could be an ongoing, you know, 10 hours a year that culminates the kids coming together. One person said, it's like the real reality show, because it is, you know. And so, yeah, trust me, if I could keep doing this, I would be a very happy camper, because I love telling these stories.
And I can absolutely see that. Easily it could be, and it could be a very powerful tool on television, where families generally watch together or kids watch on their own. It could be a very powerful tool on that medium. But in terms of the film, after the premiere, what are the hopes for the film? How are you distributing it and getting it out?
Well, we have an agent, we have representation, and another great thing about AFI in Los Angeles, the American Film Institute, is it's followed by the American Film Market, which is one of the largest markets in the world. So next week,
that's right.
We have, you know, the world converges on Santa Monica, and we have very high hopes both domestically and internationally, because obviously one of the things about it is that it's in 8 countries around the world, it's in, you know, 11 languages, and it touches a lot of, you know, a lot of hearts, so, and it resonates. So, yeah, so we're looking at both domestic and international distribution. I've just made an agreement this week with somebody to represent it, and you know, I'm very excited about that. They're very excited about it. They think that this is something. It's like everything. It's like every film, particularly something like this. You have to find the right person at the right place at the right time who gets it and reacts just like what you just said. You know, this could be great communal viewing. You use the same term, and I completely agree with you. When you go see a movie, it's so special to sit in a room with other people and share that experience. And this is something that we really could bring families together to share on a regular basis on television. We've had that reaction many times from parents and kids. This is something that it just popped in my head, that if you're 12 or 13 years old, you can watch this with your parents and not feel weird because, you know, it's not like, you know, because you realize you're the star. Your generation is the star of the show. And so your parents are kind of go, wow. Those kids are just like you.
Yeah,
and what a cool thing that is.
It's such an important film, and entertaining and inspiring, and lots of terrific personal stories involved in it. I know our chat room is abuzz now because we've let them know about this film, and now they're very anxious to see it on their own. We wish you the very best of luck with it, and come back to our show and let us know some updates on what you're up to in terms of this project and any other projects. And it's been a tremendous pleasure to speak with you tonight.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the invitation. That means a lot. And we're all in it together. And when we can make it, you know, when we can make it a better world, what's better than that? So thank you very much.
That, That's just it. TheWorldWeWantMovie.com, is that the website where they can read more about it?
TheWorldWeWantMovie.com, yes.
Okay. We'll type that in the chat room. Mr. Davidson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
That's Patrick Davidson, writer, producer, and director of The World We Want. And it is really an important movie, especially for this time, where you get a sense that these kids, they're investing in the future of the world because it's
right,
their world.
Yeah, absolutely.
What could be more important? What a great program, though, to teach kids that they do have a say in the world they live in, that they
mm-hmm.
have a hand in creating it.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's not enough of that in schools, even civics. I mean, I hear like Dreyfus on TV talking about we need to teach civics in school. And
we don't have civics anymore. I mean, I don't think they teach that anymore.
No, and such valuable kind of life lessons that you carry with you in your life and are a lot more valuable to you than some of the things that we focus on in the school curriculum.
Civics was like an elective when I was in high school. I think civics was an elective, not a requirement. And that was in like in the 80s.
Yeah.
If that says anything, so.
Yeah. That was a great guest, and we appreciate him coming on very much.
Definitely.
Okay. While we wait for our next guest, I don't believe he's arrived yet.
He has not arrived on the switchboard, okay.
I don't think so.
Okay, no, that's cool. I mean, I'm just always skeptical of that switchboard happening in the last couple of weeks. It's like
trust
the death. It's like the HAL 9000 of switchboards.
On this one. Our next guest is Ilya Smirow, and I'm sure I'm massacring that name like I always do. But he is the composer of a lot of great films that we'll introduce in a little bit. But his new project is called Splinter, which is a horror movie that's actually gotten some pretty great reviews.
It got a rave review in the Wall Street Journal, of all papers.
Really?
Morgan Stern was raving about this, and he doesn't generally like horror films, but he was just, he said this was incredible.
E-Weekly the same way, a great review from them.
Yeah, the New York Times wasn't so, said it was good, but nothing... But the Wall Street Journal, the Morgan Stern review, and he's never given a horror film a good review, at least not to my knowledge. And I was really, I'm reading this first thing Friday morning, I'm just like, okay.
Yeah. At the end of the show, we'll be premiering a track from his soundtrack score for Splinter. So we'll bill it as the world internet premiere of the score for that one. Lisa Schwartzbaum gave it a B+.
About it. And this is only the last couple of weeks that this thing's come on the radar that I've been hearing stuff about it. But I definitely want to check it out, not just because of the Wall Street Journal review. That's beside the point. I've just been hearing from a lot of different people that this is a really good film. I'm very curious to check it out.
But you saw a film this weekend that...
Film that's not as bad as everyone's making it out to be. I'm not saying it's, like, brilliant or anything like that, but I did see the Eastwood movie, Changeling. And it's after, like, a rocky first half hour, it gets into its groove. And it's not... I mean, it's definitely, a good performance from Angelina Jolie, and she's had two this year, this and Wanted... I think one of it is actually better performance for her because she doesn't say that much. But this is not that bad because I think a lot of people you have to have some patience with it because it's a good half hour too long. If this gets nominated for editing, we have serious issues with the Oscars then for editing because the film's just like sort of goes off on these tangents. But some of the tangents are very interesting. Like once I said, once you get past the first half hour, it's a really engrossing film, and I actually think it's worthwhile checking out. But I still would rather see the other Eastwood movie, Gran Torino, which looks incredible.
You think so?
Yeah, I do. I think Gran Torino looks like... I just like to see Eastwood in front of the camera, too, and it just... it's Eastwood. I mean, he's just he's a fucking icon. I mean, you just can't
just,
get around that.
It looks like unintentional comedy to me. Gran Torino does. I mean,
do you think it just looks like a rehash of Death Wish and Death Sentence and things like that?
I wasn't thinking along those lines. I mean, that movie's been made a lot, many times. You can still make a good version of it, but it looks like a parody. It looks like as Clint Eastwood's faces and that in the trailer and the whole "Get off my lawn." And I mean, it looks like you would if you would make a parody of that kind of movie. And I'm sure that's not how they're going to play it.
No,
I was talking to Chris.
Like,
Chris and I both felt the same way about it. We weren't very taken by it.
Well, you guys don't like Eastwood, though. So, I mean, there's a bias that comes in there.
No, there isn't. I mean, I think he made two of the best movies of the past 2 years. Mystic River and Million Dollar Baby. But he tore them both apart in the last 15 minutes for me. But 75% of those are great films. I don't have a bias against Eastwood.
I just know that
them.
You and Chris aren't crazy about him. I think he's one of those exceptions, like one of those actor who became directors who, yeah, I mean, I think there's some really, after Unforgiven, there's some not really good movies, but after Unforgiven and after A Perfect World, you get Absolute Power, True Crime, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which I think are horrible films, but then he comes back into this
group. See, and I actually think that Absolute Power and True Crime are fine.
Oh, I think there's not enough going on there to. I just think he was riding the whirlwind of Unforgiven. I think they're really bland. But I think then he gets back into this groove with Space Cowboys, loses again with Bloodwork, but then Mystic River comes along, and he takes a hold of Dennis Lehane very well. I like Million Dollar Baby, but it's really the two Iwo Jima movies that I think are incredible. I think both Iwo Jima movies are just out of this world. Changeling,
I just don't know how anybody can see that Gran Torino trailer and not think it's funny.
Well, I think you get a chill. I mean, look, it was rumored to be the last Dirty Harry movie for a while, and you could see that. But I don't. I mean, I would love to see Eastwood back in front of the camera, even if it's doing something like that. I was more thinking Death Sentence more than anything else, though. Because
yeah,
it's like he
that.
Wants to go after these Korean punks.
Yeah, and Death Sentence was a ripoff of Taxi Driver. So.
Yeah, I know you didn't like Death Sentence. I know. I liked it, but I know you didn't.
Yeah. So The Changeling, this is interesting, too, because remember when it premiered at Cannes Film Festival and everyone was raving about not the movie, but Angelina Jolie's performance. It's one of those where they rave about the performance and that's all you get out of the review, and then you think, yeah, but how's the movie?
and they're not even raving
about
Jolie anymore.
Since but they did at Cannes.
Yeah,
it premiered here in the States, it's a different story.
Yeah, it's a good performance. I wouldn't say, they're all saying it's Oscar bait. I would honestly have to say that the Oscar this year belongs to Meryl Streep. Unless Kate Winslet or someone, I think Meryl Streep has it sewn up with doubt, and I haven't even.
I think it's definitely between Kate Winslet and Meryl Streep.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see. It's a good performance from her, but it's not something I would say. Oh, this is one for the ages kind of thing. I think
right.
Every time I see that trailer for Doubt, I'm just like, shit, Streep has it sewn up.
That looks like a great film.
Yeah.
But it's telling because they're pushing movies out of the schedule this year that we thought would be Oscar frontrunners. A great female performance, and you and I were both saying it after Cannes. We were saying, well, it looks like Angelina Jolie's a lock.
Right.
Now that looks like it's in doubt, even though are there enough great female lead performances in films that have gotten the notoriety to fill out that ballot this Oscar season.
I think you got Kate Winslet for either Revolutionary Road or The Reader. I think it may go to The Reader, actually. I think I would say Nicole Kidman for Australia is a shoe-in.
Right.
I think everyone in doubt, because everyone was nominated for a Tony in doubt, so I think it's going to be Hoffman, Streep, and Amy Adams
who
will be nominated.
No doubt.
Yeah, no doubt. There you go.
Yeah. Australia. I read about Australia today. Baz Luhrmann, he's working overtime to get it done. I think it releases November 26th. He's actually turning it into the studio reel by reel.
Yeah.
That's how down to the wire it is. This is the most expensive movie ever made in Australia.
They're going with the wind.
Yeah, it's a big tentpole picture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it'll be inventive and exciting, visually at least, as all Baz Luhrmann films are.
Yeah, I think it's there's a real possibility this could be, if it's good, that it's going to dominate. But I think, yeah, it's going to look like Kidman, Streep, and Winslet, and maybe there's some other, maybe Angelina Jolie, but those are the ones I can think of right
yeah.
now off the top of my head.
In terms of actors, it's an exciting year for actors because we have, as we mentioned before, Sean Penn in Milk. That looks like a tailor-made performance, and a film, too. If you look at the possible Best Picture contenders for the February ceremony, it looks like Milk, both in terms of politics, in terms of the underdog and the that kind of feeling you get from the
mm-hmm.
movie.
I think
it looks
it's
like
be
a shoo-in.
Best actors between Mickey Rourke and Sean Penn. It's the
yeah,
80s
yeah,
bad
yeah, yeah.
boys. That's what it's going to be between those two.
And if you ask Sean Penn will say, give it to Mickey Rourke, because Mickey Rourke is a big hero for Sean Penn,
yeah.
and a great many actors, and that would be the story of all movie stories for the
yeah.
year.
Yeah, and
Mickey
the
Rourke
other two
best actor.
Actresses we didn't, is you got to put Anne Hathaway for Rachel getting married.
Yes, yes.
And you really have to put, and I do think Kristin Scott Thomas will get nominated for I've Loved You So Long. I do
yeah.
really feel in my heart that she's going to get nominated.
Rachel Getting Married is interesting. Aaron seems to think that he's predicting early that Anne Hathaway will win for Rachel Getting Married. I mean,
possible.
It seems like it seems early to speculate about anything if we haven't seen the movies. I mean, all of the movies involved. It's like trying to predict who will win the Super Bowl right now.
Right.
But it'll be an interesting race and just a lot, not a lot to choose from as I thought that there would be.
What's a disappointing fall season? A really disappointing fall season. But I will say this, and you can't rule out, I do think there's a talk in the chat room, there is talk that The Dark Knight and Wall-E will
yeah.
both be nominated. And they sort of, and I would think that's a smart thing to do. If you want the ratings to go up, you have to do this. If you nominate
yeah.
the films we're talking about yeah. before this, you ain't going to get good ratings. I'll tell you that right now.
And I think that they deserve it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one thing you talk about ratings, and I'm sure there'll be people saying that it's a cynical move just to get more ratings, but are they two of the best films of the year? And if they are, they deserve to be there. And The Dark Knight has impressed me on an equal or a greater level than anything else I've seen.
Yeah, it deserves to be there. I mean, I would nominate a smaller film like In Bruges, but it's just too small. But that's my favorite movie of the year, besides Dark Knight and Wall-E. I mean, those three right there, I have a hard time picking a favorite. But
yeah.
And The Visitor, we can't rule out The Visitor. But I don't know if that's too far back. I don't know the way.
I'm sure In Bruges will get a writing nomination.
Yeah.
Especially since it comes from such a very influential playwright, and this is his first screenplay, if I'm correct.
Yeah, this is his
yeah.
first. He had a short film before that, but yeah, I mean, it definitely deserves that. I would give, something needs to be given to Colin Farrell for that, and Cassandra's Dream, and for his part in Pride and Glory. This has been a revolutionary year for him.
He's
done incredible work.
He's gotten better and better.
Yeah.
He's gotten better and better the more he does. And he talked about how much Alexander experience stung. I think he was interviewed last week, and he talked about, man, it took me forever to get over that because this was a huge movie, and I had to carry it, essentially, and I felt like I was a failure. And it took him a while to get his footing back. Another
mm-hmm.
interview that occurred at the Rome Film Festival where, by the way, they paid tribute to Al Pacino, but that's neither
mm-hmm.
here nor there. They interviewed Michael Cimino. Did you read this?
No, now is he a woman yet? Because I heard in Vanity Fair they said he was getting a sex change, and that was in 2002. Is he a woman
yeah.
yet, or is that never materialized?
Well, I saw pictures of him from the Rome Film Festival, and it is pretty startling. But no, I don't think so.
Well, he went through some sort of, like, he got a massive operation for something.
He did. You can tell he's had work done.
Uh-huh.
But
is he
going to
direct anything?
He said he wants to. He says he's been writing screenplays this whole time, and he hasn't been able to find funding for them, whether that's his name that he thinks is so soiled, or the the value of the screenplays themselves. I don't know what that has to do with. He says that one of the projects looks promising, and he can't wait to get back in front of the camera, behind the camera. But he talked a lot, just like Colin Farrell, he talked a lot about his big disastrous project and how that really set him back, which was Heaven's Gate. And he said,
but it's considered a classic now.
Yeah, I mean, it's had some revisionist thinking applied to it. He said, man, I felt like a leper after I did that movie, and nobody would talk to me, and I couldn't get anything off the ground. And
well, that was his own doing.
He
charged United Artists to use the land that the film was shot on. He was making a killing during that. He was charging them to use the land. I mean, he helped destroy that.
When I worked for AMC, that was required reading among the management was that book. Was it Final Cut? Or, yeah. Big disastrous story there.
Yeah, I mean, and the
sad
thing is,
handle. Go ahead.
Yeah, the sad thing is that's not even Heaven's Gate is like minor compared to some of the other stuff that's come after it. I mean, they're a disaster. It's and you're right though. He never really recovered. Even though I think Year of the Dragon is an excellent film. After Year of the Dragon, he did sort. You know, he really just fumbled. He never really came back.
I always loved Year of the Dragon 2.
Yeah.
But I never took it seriously. I mean, I loved it. I enjoy watching it the same way I kind of enjoy watching True Blood now, because it's just, it's a trashy kind of movie.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I actually think Year of the Dragon is an excellent film. I mean,
I do too.
And I don't even think True Blood is trashy. You don't spend that kind of money to make trash.
Oh, then Alan Ball is not on the ball because he said I wanted to make trash.
Oh, yeah, I don't think, you don't ever want to say, I don't think people in this day and age, unless it's like direct-to-DVD or something, when you have a budget, and especially a budget like, I don't think it's not advisable to say, oh, I'm making great trash. You don't want to do that.
I think it's a great indication of what the show is. I mean, that's why I love
don't,
it.
But I don't think you ever want to advertise that. But it is a good show. I think it's very enjoyable. But it's like when I sort of go with the Keith theory here. There's no such thing as a guilty pleasure. I sort of think I don't think anyone sets out to make trash.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like
it is a fun show, though. I mean, I don't think you could ask for a better show on pay cable than that.
Yeah. But I can't really get a handle on Michael Cimino. Who he is as a filmmaker, but it really is part of the wave that happened post-70s, and for some it happened in the late 70s, where our big directors, they had the passion project that was bigger than they were, and that marked their kind of downfall.
Right.
And Heaven's Gate was kind of the last of that breed that hit Cimino. I mean, you had Friedkin with Sorcerer and there's Scorsese with New York, and no matter what the reevaluations are now,
at the time, the press ate. I mean, they were eaten alive. And Coppola was too. One from the Heart. I mean, you know, now it's considered because of the DVD released a couple of years ago, but for years that was considered a disaster, even though on a production scale and a technologically, it was ahead of its time that he would do everything on video.
Right.
It was way ahead of its time.
It was. And all of these movies have their merits, but it speaks to a couple of things. First of all, the ego. It was a director-controlled system, and they were the all-powerful. And they thought they could do anything. And it happened with one filmmaker after another from that period.
You could say it happened with Lucas eventually when he finally returned to directing with The Phantom Menace. You have to have someone there who's going to tell you, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. At the same time, how many billions of dollars did the new Star Wars movies make?
It doesn't matter. I mean, I'm just saying from a quality perspective. No, billions. I mean, dude. And then the funny thing is he can't leave it alone. He said, I'll never touch it again. Every week it's like, oh, I want to do this and this. And I mean, come on.
Yeah. So I'm fascinated by that dichotomy there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess you could say Spielberg, with 1941.
Throw it, just get more and more grandiose and forget about kind of the touches that brought you where you are, the emotional kind of honesty and that made you what you are in that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And movies outgrew them. I mean, the public taste post-Star Wars kind of really started to outgrow that material.
Right.
Not outgrow. It wasn't a growth. It was a drifting away. It wasn't a maturity that occurred, I don't think. Anyway. We have Wednesday night, Damian Harris, and we're going to talk soundtracks too. We're going to premiere some selected scores from some new soundtracks that are available that we've been given that we haven't been able to speak about yet. We'll try to reschedule with Aaliyah Smirow on a future date. He's an interesting guy. His big break really came from John Frankenheimer, hired him to do Ronin. And he does a lot of electronic scoring, and I'm interested in electronic scoring. It's a new wave, like all this electronic stuff, and it works almost like sound effects,
mm-hmm.
more so, you know, in some films. Anyway, that's my take.
No, I like Ronin's. You know, was a very good film. I enjoyed that. That was a good one. God, what was that? That was like 10 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
10 or 11 years ago, wow.
We're getting old, Jerry.
Oh, I know, we're getting old. I've been saying that for years. Oh, I love this in the chat room. Our good buddy Mike from Horror Movie Fans Radio has said, Cimino is a mediocre, but The Deer Hunter was great in spite of him. I agree with that, Mike. I'm not a big Michael Cimino worshiper. I don't know if I'm really much of a worshiper of anyone anymore. It gets hard after a while. But Michael Cimino was, though there's an interesting, I would love to read a biography of him, though.
I would, too. The thing is, I guess it's because he's made so few movies.
The Sun Chaser was the last one.
Yeah, and there have been some Desperate Hours Sun Chaser that aren't that great, and you can blame it on, well, did he get support? Was he director for hire? Was
mm-hmm.
this and that? I can't get a sense of what kind of filmmaker he is, what his strengths are, necessarily.
Well, there's the whole thing also about The Deer Hunter. You know, it's a great movie. It turns out in that article that we read earlier this year in Vanity Fair, he lied about a lot of stuff, about his involvement. You know, there's a lot of, the making of that movie must be fascinating. I don't know. Cimino is like, there's a question mark about
Cimino.
I don't know much about him.
Yeah, there is a real interesting topic to be brought up in terms of The Deer Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
The whole racist aspect of it, because that was the big claim against The Deer Hunter, especially first upon its release, was
yeah.
it was a racist film.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
And it's an interesting topic.
The thing with Year of the Dragon.
Different show.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, we're trying to fill out the hour here.
Right.
So no, the same with Year of the Dragon. That was also had the same allegations, too, when it
and
came out.
And Year of the Dragon almost works as kind of an apology.
I would think it's a sequel to Deer Hunter.
Some supposed racism in Deer
yeah.
Hunter, because if you think they made one of the protagonists Chinese, and try to bring in a sympathetic kind of character in the middle of that, which Deer Hunter didn't have. But my point is, with Deer Hunter, there was no none of the characters' points of view allow for that kind of character. I mean, sympathetic characters aren't involved in that. It's all about the conflict, the war,
yeah.
killing one another between
mm-hmm.
both sides.
Yeah.
We're not telling the other side story. And to actually tell the other side story would be taking you out of the frame of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I...
Maybe I'm ignorant.
No, you're not ignorant. No, it is. It is, dude. It is about the lives of those people in that small town. That's what the
yeah.
film is about, and how the war affects them. And how war
yeah.
affects... It doesn't matter what the war. Easily, there might be films made about Iraq and Afghanistan in many years from now about
mm-hmm.
that. So it's just that the Vietnam War is the film at the time. Is the,
yeah.
you know, and I think that's what it's about. If we go to we do the VC side of the story, you're right. That would take you out, and it would be a much longer movie too.
And who needs that? I apologize if I've offended any of our listeners in Vietnam.
No, it would just be, you're talking about a 6-hour film.
Right, right. But that's an interesting topic.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the next big movie we're looking forward to this month?
I would say for me it's James Bond, Milk, Australia. I hope Australia is going to come out November 26th, or I wonder if it's just going to be one of those limited release, like, you know, Oscar qualifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking forward to The Road, but that's not coming out until sometime next year.
I'm looking forward to Milk. The reviews for the Bond, which there have been no reviews for Milk, and it premiered, and critics saw it. I don't know if there's an embargo on previews.
There is an embargo.
Reviews. Yeah. Anyway, we submitted interview requests to everyone involved with Milk, so we're waiting to hear something. But the new Bond picture, obviously, that did screen, and reviews are up on that. That opens next Friday, correct?
2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, but on the 14th.
Okay. The word on this is that it's the shortest Bond yet,
mm-hmm.
and it's filled with action. I mean, unusually so, more so than any other Bond movie. It's wall-to-wall action. So I'm up for it.
I'm up for it. I mean, I think what he's brought to the character, and I also think it's very interesting, he plays Bond, and then at the end of December, he plays one of the partisans in Defiance, of the three brothers who fight the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a very good year for him.
What are these Nazi movies?
Nazi movies? Yeah, there's that in Valkyrie. And
then Inglourious Bastards, Tarantino's new one.
Well, that would be a whole show unto itself right there. I mean, Tarantino doing a World War II film. We've been waiting for like a decade for this ever since he announced it. So is this a new trend?
Like Nazis in the multiplex? Is this
no? They are always Nazis in the multiplex. They never left us. They're the ultimate villains.
Yeah,
they're the ultimate villains. Now the interesting thing about Valkyrie is that Tom Cruise looks exactly like height wise and everything like Von Stauffenburg. And it'll be very.
And he makes no attempt at. No attempted accent at all.
I think that's probably smart. Let me say this. There are two films that preceded this, two excellent films, Night of the Generals, where the plot to kill Hitler is a subplot, and then there's one with that was with Peter O'Toole and Omar Sharif, superb film that's not on DVD, and then there's another one with James Mason, The Desert Fox, where he plays Rommel. These are excellent films. Not everyone's talking with English accents, so, I mean... You know, no one tries to make do the German thing.
That's what Costner should have done with Robin Hood. He should just forget about the accent. In your normal California surfer, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sizzle Beach, anyway. USA.
Okay. We apologize for our second guest not showing. We'll see what we can do to get him back here, possibly Wednesday night. But in the meantime... We're going to premiere a cut off of his new score for the movie Splinter, and then we'll be out of here. Thanks for joining us tonight, and we'll see you Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. Go vote on Tuesday.
Exactly. Vote.
Was that convincing? Okay.
Go vote. Nothing is more important than voting.
Here's Splinter.